Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the new migrant community, aging Americans looking for work.
But first to the fighting in Gaza, which continues today with a UN agency calling a strike against a primary school for girls that killed at least 15, a source of universal shame. The school had been turned into a shelter for Gazans forced to flee their homes, and the UN is blaming Israel for the strike. Sudarshan Raghavan of The Washington Post is in Gaza. He joins us via Skype. Sudarshan, welcome.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, you visited this UN-run school that was struck this morning. What did you see?
It was quite devastated. One of the classrooms where about 50 people were sleeping in is completely, the roof is completely ripped apart. It's in rubble. The outside gate was also hit. And there's a couple other shells who hit the school in other areas. But the main destruction was in this classroom. When I got there, there were actually two young boys picking up pieces of body, a piece of flesh to put in a plastic bag in order to get to take it and have it buried. So it was a pretty grim, grim sight.
What else are you seeing today in Gaza? We know that the primary electric plant there was also hit.
That's correct. I visited the plant yesterday, and it was just huge plumes of smoke, fire, just coming out of the fuel tank. Today, the impact, well, there's been no electricity in Gaza City, really no water either. People are lucky enough to have generators, have also struggled to find fuel. It's gotten more expensive. I visited a hospital, actually the very hospital where many of the victims from the school were brought to. Their generators are working full time now. And the concern is the generators are going to get worn out eventually soon, and that could cause humanitarian obstacles in the future.
How are Israeli officials justifying some of these strikes? Obviously, some of them are on targets that they were going after, but clearly some of these things that are being hit in Gaza were not places that Israel had any real motivation to hit.
No, exactly. The Israelis have been giving different reasons. In this particular attack, one spokeswoman claimed that the Israeli soldiers were fighting Hamas militants and who were firing from the direction of the school, and the Israelis fired back. So that could be one explanation. A couple of days ago, the Israelis put out a video showing a mortar, Israeli mortar, hitting an empty schoolyard, offering that as proof that they did not attack another UN facility, UN school that killed 16 people a few days ago. It's basically a tit-for-tat verbal assault that's been happening so far in the past few days.
How are people in Gaza who have not been hit in these attacks getting by with their normal lives, water, food, even bathrooms? How are people coping?
Very difficult, especially now that the power plant is gone. I mean, you've got people trying to fetch water from like water tanks that are still have some water. You've got others, trying to, I mean, just basically living in darkness at night. I think the big concern amongst the health officials in Gaza now is that as long as the electricity keeps out and they can't fix it, they're worried about the sewage treatment plants.
And what about the support for Hamas in Gaza? Israel has said that one of its goals here is to diminish support for Hamas, to remove the legitimacy of Hamas. There are people rallying around Hamas. Are they backing away? How are Palestinians feeling?
There's certainly a cross of people who are fed up with by both sides. But at the same time, it's hard to find anyone who is critical of Hamas. Most people I've interviewed have said that they believe in the Hamas, which they refer to as the Palestinian resistance. They don't want a ceasefire unless all Palestinian demands are met. There's a good amount of support still for Hamas, and with each. With each attack, especially on schools, especially on power plants and other infrastructure, for example, a lot of factories have been hit, a number of mosques have been hit. My sense is that it's rather than pushing Palestinians against Hamas, it's actually giving Hamas more support. People seem to be seeing these attacks as even more reason why their demands need to be met.
That's Sudarshan Raghavan of The Washington Post joining us from Gaza. Sudarshan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
People joke about not being able to retire, but for many older Americans in their 50s, 60s, their 80s, it's not funny. Their savings depleted, their monthly Social Security check, if they get one, maybe $400 or so, not enough to cover rent. So they're taking to the road in RVs, moving from beet field to pumpkin patch, taking tickets at NASCAR races, taking a lot of ibuprofen, stocking warehouses for Amazon. They're working. They call themselves work campers. Others have called them the Okies of the Great Recession, a reference to the farmers who fled the Dust Bowl during the Depression. And Jessica Bruder's eye-opening story, The End of Retirement When You Can't Afford to Stop Working, in the August issue of Harper's, tells their story. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you.
Boy, this eye-opener isn't the word for it. It's a heartbreaker, too.
It's amazing. A lot of people who did the right thing, they worked all their lives, they put money away if and when they could, you see them out there. And it's not a predictable crew of people. I met everyone from a gentleman who in the 70s for a few years had been the head of product development for McDonald's, and another guy who'd been a State Department teaching fellow, 77, working in an Amazon warehouse and living in an RV.
Well, so some people lost all their savings in the banking collapse. Others, like Linda May, you introduced us to her right away, you know, might have lived with their families, but then their families had tough times and don't have room for them, just had a downsize and didn't have room for Linda May. Tell us more about her.
Sure. Linda has held a variety of jobs. She's been everything from a cocktail waitress to an insurance executive to doing construction. She is one tough cookie. But in the modern economic climate, working that hard and being one tough cookie doesn't necessarily mean you've got a pension. Mm. So while she has saved where she could, her Social Security amounts to $499 a month, and that's not a heck of a lot.
Yeah, it doesn't cover rent. And again, people shouldn't presume that you might have jobs, but that doesn't necessarily translate into pensions and savings. So she did not have a job that provided a pension. And again, her family didn't have room for her. How desperate was she?
When I spoke with her, she recounted a time in 2010 where she almost thought about pulling the plug. I mean, she was living in a trailer in New River, Arizona. She was working as a Home Depot cashier. All the money she was making was going back into rent. And basically, she was looking down this tunnel of days where that was what she was going to be doing for the rest of her life, never being able to retire, just kind of putting the money back in, feeling isolated. And she said, with a tinge of black humor, but she meant it, that she thought about the quote in the story is, I'm going to drink all the booze, I'm going to turn on the propane, I'm going to pass out, and that'll be it.
Yeah.
And if I wake up, I'm going to light a cigarette and blow us all to hell. Now, when Linda says that, she's half cackling, but you know she also said it to herself.
Right. And by the way, how old's Linda at this point in your story?
Linda was 60 years old then. That was 2010.
Which, you know, many people, you know, think isn't that old, but it's certainly an age where you're going to have a hard time getting a full-time job with a good pension. So she falls into this rabbit hole that you also discovered and bring us into, of this world of people selling everything, buying RVs and going on the road, and finding out about this through websites from other people. Tell us about Bob Wells.
Oh, Bob Wells is amazing. So there's a website called cheaprvliving.com, and it was one of the first resources that Linda stumbled across as she was trying to figure out how to live the next chunk of her life. Bob Wells started that website. He was a Safeway clerk in Alaska in the 90s. He had a fine income for one family, but when he got divorced and basically found himself supporting himself as almost an independent mini unit and then wife and child, he had to move into a box van. And at first, he told me he was quite ashamed. He said, you know, am I the social outcast? Am I the guy who lives down by the river, just kind of looking at these tropes? And then basically, he came to embrace it. He came to embrace this nomadic lifestyle. He started putting together resources, lessons he'd learned, everything from stealth parking, which is a fancy way to say how not to get pushed around by police when you're trying to find a place to park your rig and sleep, to putting photovoltaic solar panels on your rig, to going and finding cheap dentistry in Los Algodones, Mexico, which is a really popular place with these guys.
As you move further into this community yourself and start meeting all of these elderly people traveling the country, you say just about everybody's been to that town.
Just about everybody had either come from Los Algodones or planned to go to have a tooth pulled or a crown put in or dentures fixed. It was definitely a pilgrimage spot.
Well, so Bob Wells has a website that tells people about a lot of these, you know, ways to live on the road. Linda May starts living on the road. She buys an RV for $4,000. And this brings us into this world of, you know, traveling the country looking for work. Thousands of elderly, this community, in their RVs, moving from place to place. She had a job, a seasonal job at Yosemite National Park. What did she do there?
She was camp hosting, which means you're taking camp fees, you're welcoming guests, and you're scrubbing toilets, which is probably the least popular part of the job. So you're basically being the host, you're doing some maintenance, you're cleaning up. And many, many parks around the country offer these jobs, and they're pretty much always for RVers.
Yeah. So that's one of the seasonal jobs that people take. She moves on, though, to Amazon, and this is fascinating and kind of out of the headlines. Amazon is really taking advantage of this worker force.
Well, it's wild. They have a program that began in 2008 called Camper Force, and it was just an experiment. In some of their warehouses that are further away from major population centers, they have a tricky time getting the temporary flex staff that you need to meet the peak rush. So we're talking everywhere from early fall right up until Christmas, when the kind of consumer frenzy hits its peak. And they discovered this population of work campers, which, you know, it's actually kind of an employer's dream, right? You don't need a house for them. They show up. They show up with the house, they're ready to go, and they disappear when you don't need them. They pretty much create these ephemeral company towns in RV parks. So Amazon discovered that in 2008 and just started really mining it, to the point where now I approached an Amazon Camper Force recruiter in Quartzsite, Arizona, and was told that the headcount for the Camper Force program had grown to 2,000 people.
Just part of this coast-to-coast network of older Americans looking for work in a somewhat underground economy and often invisible labor force, but one that, as we're hearing, a lot of businesses are well aware of and are actually recruiting. Jessica Bruder tells their story in her piece, The End of Retirement, When You Can't Afford to Stop Working. It's in the August issue of Harper's. You're listening to Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation with Jessica Bruder. Her sometimes jaw-dropping article in Harper's, The End of Retirement, When You Can't Afford to Stop Working, tells of an underground economy of older Americans living in RVs, traveling the country from seasonal job to job, including loading Amazon's cavernous warehouse in Fernley, Nevada. Some of those RV drivers may be listening in campgrounds set up just for them right now. Jessica also reminds us that German statesman Otto von Bismarck first floated the idea of helping people stop working back in 1883, this idea of retirement. William Osler, who founded Johns Hopkins, picked up the idea as a way to help the aging but also clear the way for the young to get jobs. And the Great Depression sealed that thinking, the New Deal, asking Americans to contribute to a Social Security fund, which became part of a three-legged stool, Social Security, pensions, and personal investments. But as Jessica reminds us, pensions have been replaced by 401ks, many personal investments went south in the recession, and Social Security for many people is just $400 a month, not enough for rent. So Jessica met people like Linda May in her 60s, now one of the so-called work campers, who follow jobs, learn tricks for survival at work camper websites. There are even job fairs. Jessica Bruder, you found one called The Big Tent in Quartzsite, Arizona?
It was kind of amazing to walk into the tent because I thought to myself, where else in America right now are people so hungry to hire people in the demographic we were calling ARP and up? So not elderly, but 50 and up. I mean, that is a really hard demographic if you're freshly jobless, to get a new job out of. And it's not a demographic that a lot of people are actively recruiting. So seeing that was absolutely fascinating. You've got Amazon has a dedicated program, the Camper Force. The beet harvest. American Crystal Sugar harvests sugar beets seasonally in the Red River Valley, and that's some cold, rough work. These people aren't literally in the fields hauling out the beets. That's done by machines now, but they are out there at night guiding the trucks in, cleaning up beets. You know, they're riding bobcats. They are, by which I mean the machine, not the beast. they're hauling around 30-pound bags of beets that are sample bags, and they're doing it on 12-hour shifts, sometimes in freezing cold overnight. They sell fireworks at roadside stands. They pick pumpkins. There are all sorts of jobs.
Well, and there's all sorts of underground ways to find them. There's websites with names like Workers on Wheels, Work Camper News. Some companies offer bed and board. Others a place to park. But no benefits. You know, a lot of these people don't have health care. You say the beet harvest isn't as hard as it once was, but you talked to a worker on a faulty machine who he was being pelted by the beets. He said it was like being hit with potatoes. And
yeah, he said it was like getting strafed with an automatic potato gun. I think it's very hard. It's just people initially picture that folks are out there in the fields with, you know,
baskets,
shovels and stuff, and that's not quite what's happening, right. But what's happening is not easy.
It's hard work. Linda May, when she worked in an Amazon warehouse, this is a 10-hour workday walking on concrete slab floors and hauling very heavy product at times.
Absolutely. And Amazon knows it's hard work. They have a process called work hardening which to me just sounded, that was such a wild piece of slang, almost bizarrely honest, you know, hardening you for the work, where they're kind of ramping you up to that full day, getting you used to walking on the concrete. And these warehouses have med stations called AmCare. I mean, they're ready. They know things can happen in that environment.
And so what are these, again, older people, how do they handle the hardness of the work?
Well, the people themselves are amazing. I mean, it's a funny balance to walk in a story like this because the economy is so bleak, but the dignity and the resilience of the people is so amazing to me and so inspiring to me that it's hard to talk about both pieces at the same time almost because, you know, they don't see themselves as victims.
In fact, some of them see themselves as liberated.
Absolutely. And I think that's a coping mechanism. But who am I as a reporter coming out to visit to tell them otherwise? You know, when people can find joy, that's great. I don't think that is any reason to ignore the current state of the economy and retirement finance.
Yeah.
I think it's really a testament to these people as individuals.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, you know, the joy part. I mean, these become communities. They live together on these campgrounds during the months or so that they're working in different seasonal work. You know, they help each other out.
They have these amazing micro economies. This is so cool. You go into the laundry room at any one of these RV parks and you realize that, you know, there are flyers everywhere for services because there's this sub economy where people who aren't doing the warehouse work, maybe they're physically unable to, you don't have a high school degree, Amazon requires that, maybe, you know, you're just not doing it for whatever reason. So you've got people who are walking dogs, preparing meals, doing RV upholstery. You've got this kind of whole sub-economic network that forms. And there are also some pretty incredible social bonds. But I think hardship does bring people together. You know, it's not always the best way to bond, but the bonds are undeniably strong.
Well, and they have to be, because again, I have to keep coming back to it. This work is hard. You meet Linda Chesser, a former Washington State University academic advisor, who's now in this life, and she tells you, this is the first time I've ever done factory work, and I have a whole new respect for it. But she's also taking 4 ibuprofen in the morning and 4 when she gets home at night.
I know. It was all I could do not to think, oh, your liver. I mean, I thought it. I just didn't, you know, I didn't want to say something judgmental, but that's not really a sustainable way to deal with pain.
Well, but how do they get medical care?
Not easily. So Linda needed some medical care at one point. They took her to AmCare. She got an ambulance to Reno, had to pay the cab fare back herself, which was, you know, well over $100. A lot of people I've met don't even want to access their Medicare because it takes $100 out of Social Security. And that's $100 that they would rather use to, you know, eat.
Well, but in that way, they are like migrant workers.
They are. I mean, in the literal sense of migrant workers, they are migrant workers. They're moving around from job to job.
Well, they seek refuge during the winter months in a place called Quartzsite, Arizona. You mentioned the town. It's, as you say, it's a migrant's Shangri-La.
Burning Man for geezers, one of my sources said.
Well, and here they do something called boondocking. What's that?
So boondocking is a fun word for dry camping. That means you are parked in your RV, but you're not using hookups for electricity or water. So some of them are running on generators or solar, stuff like that. But you're really just out in the desert, which in many places in Quartzsite, you can camp for free for up to 2 weeks, or it's actually quite cheap to camp for the season. So it's a place where these people can go financially dormant and bond.
So you meet this community, and they are making their way now. But you alluded to how, you know, who am I to comment on this joy they feel they've found? But you do comment in the article about your fears for this community. What are they?
I worry about them very much. I mean, bodies don't last, RVs don't last. You know, we're finite vessels. And What do you do when you can't go out on the road? What do you do when you can't lift that 30-pound bag of beets or stay up all night in the Amazon warehouse? The weirdest thing is these aren't some other alien people. These people really are us. After the story came out, I found somebody that I met at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous is my old friend's mother. I found out I was just in San Francisco and a good friend of mine said, oh, I know that character. She used to live in this city and was working on this volunteer project with me. They're not some other people. Do you know what I mean? It's not. There are families, and that is what is so important about this to me.
Jessica Bruder, her story, The End of Retirement, When You Can't Afford to Stop Working, is in the August issue of Harper's, a must-read. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So, your thoughts on work campers. We'd love to hear from you. Leave a comment at hereandnow.org.
Argentinian bonds are rallying to multi-year highs today, even as the country is on the verge of defaulting on its debt payments. Investors are hopeful that Argentina can make good at the last minute on a $1.5 billion payment to American hedge funds. But if that doesn't happen by midnight tonight, it will be the second time Argentina defaults in 13 years. Joining us from New York with the details is Michael Regan, editor-at-large with Bloomberg News. Michael, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, how big of a deal of it is it, first of all, if Argentina does default again?
Well, it's a huge deal domestically for Argentina. You know, obviously, their goal is to sort of return to international capital markets so that they're able to borrow money like so many other countries to fund their government. From a broader sort of global financial aspect, it's not a huge deal because this debt is just not very systemically important to, you know, the global financial markets. You know, if you compare it to U.S. treasuries, which are used as collateral for countless financial dealings, you know, this debt in Argentina is highly speculative, so it's not as, you know, important as some of the benchmark bonds in countries like the U.S. or Germany.
Well, and take us back to where this started, because Argentina now has a long history of this. In 2001, it stopped making payments on a $100 billion debt. What's going on this time?
So this is actually, you know, closely related to that occurrence. So in 2001, Argentina defaulted. And in the ensuing years, they restructured their debt with a lot of the bondholders. And what that means, it's kind of like, you know, if you owe your credit card company a lot of money and they get tired of hounding you for it, they'll eventually come and say, how about we settle for 50 cents on the dollar? So Argentina did exactly that with, you know, about 92% of its bondholders settling for 30 cents on the dollar of what they were owed. There were holdouts, though, including hedge fund manager Paul Singer. His Elliott Management is the most high profile among the holdouts, who said, no, we want to be paid in full. So what's occurring now is a U.S. judge, the case was taken to U.S. District Court in New York, and he said that Argentina cannot pay off those who agreed to restructure the debt until they pay off the holdouts. And there's another clause in the restructuring agreement that says if, you know, Argentina offers a better deal to any other bondholder, then all of those parties that agreed to the restructuring can now come back and get that deal. So Argentina doesn't want to give these holdouts, Paul Singer and the other hedge funds, a better deal than it already restructured with the rest of the bondholders, out of fear that they will all come back with their $29 billion in debt and say, we want that deal too.
And we know that in Argentina, they're calling these hedge funds vultures. What is the incentive for Argentina to listen to what a U.S. judge says about what they have to do?
Yeah, you know, well, obviously, they, you know, if they want to continue to do business in the U.S., you know, and potentially have, you know, further legal claims against them in the U.S., they have to, you know, play ball with the American rules.
And what about this last minute push to meet the deadline? Tell us what's going on today.
Well, as you said, the bonds are rallying. The stock index in Argentina, the Merval index, is up more than 6%. It's having one of its best 2 days in about 12 years. And one of the reasons is that a bunch of representatives from the major banks in Argentina, as well as the economy minister, have flown to New York to really try to hammer out this deal. And the banks are potentially actually going to buy out the holdout bond, hedge fund bond investors. And that is one possible outcome that has people excited.
So make your reservations now at the Argentinian restaurants in New York, because they're probably going to be very busy tonight with the last minute negotiations going on. Michael Regan, editor at large with Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As we scan the headlines, it feels as if children have become targets. Girls kidnapped in Nigeria, kids murdered by gangs in Central America, and then the victims of war. In South Sudan, children may soon face famine. 200 children have been killed in Gaza, and the war in Syria is referred to as a children's crisis by aid workers. The BBC's Lise Doucette has been reporting there.
Tarek Mazloum is from a local charity trying to help Syrian refugees.
How little are the children? What have you seen here in the field?
Between 4 to 14. Each one takes about $4 each day for working between 4 or 6 hours. Very difficult.
The children have no choice?
No, their only choice is to work.
Jacqueline Baba is a professor of human rights at Harvard University and joins us on a tough phone line from Mumbai, but it's worth a listen. Jacqueline, children have always been endangered, but do you think that there is something else going on here?
I think you're right. I think that more than ever, children are in the firing line. We've known since 1996, when Graca Machel did her famous report on child soldiers, that children were implicated in war in a way that they hadn't been, say, half a century earlier. But I think at the moment, the conflicts that you mentioned, Syria, Gaza, the Nigerian girls, the U.S. border, really highlight the extent to which children are at risk in situations of conflict or situations of emergency. Now, it's difficult to say whether something has really changed because we don't have a pre-baseline which we can compare things to. But I think that there are probably several factors here which might explain why we have this sense of something different. One, children are being specifically targeted in certain contexts. And I think the Syrian civil war is a good example. We've known right from the start of that civil war that children were being killed in unusual numbers in a way to brutalize certain communities and to really send a message of terror.
Well, let's be clear, because by that you mean that the Assad regime, the ruling regime in Syria, has targeted children living in areas held by opponents.
I think that's correct. I think right from the early days in Homs, it seemed that children were specific targets. And of course, as you said in your opening comments, we know now that millions of children, I think over 1.25 million children, are refugees. The other conflicts that you mentioned, I don't think there is real evidence of targeting of children, but as in Gaza, you know, there's nowhere for children to hide anymore because homes are targeted, rooftops are targeted, as she notes. And so the places where children just stay, whether it's at home or playing in outside their house, have become extremely dangerous.
We're wondering if part of this shift, if you will, is because wars are being fought in different ways than they used to be. They're not two armies meeting on a great plain face to face.
For sure. Wars no longer are limited to the battlefield. So civilians are absolutely targeted and there aren't safe spaces as they used to be. And so where you have civilian populations where, say, 50% in some countries more are children, then, of course, by definition, lots of children are going to be targeted and killed.
Well, and what to do about this? Take Gaza, for instance. The UN Human Rights Council is weighing creating a commission to investigate possible Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip. They claim that Israel has been targeting UN schools that are being used for refugee camps, places they know are harboring children. But President Netanyahu of Israel says war crimes should be leveled against the Palestinians for using civilians as human shields and building tunnels from private homes. You know, meanwhile, workers in Gaza say children more than ever are suffering casualties there. When both sides point fingers, what's to be done?
I think this is very, very difficult. I mean, I think we are witnessing a situation where the normal rules of war, the rules of civility have completely broken down. I think the UN reported last week that a child was dying every hour in Gaza. So though clearly there are violations on both sides, but I do think that the first port of call now is to ensure that Israeli massive bombardment halts and that there's some sort of real commitment to a ceasefire. I mean, that's obviously the most urgent thing because so many people are being killed in Gaza.
But what about overall? What do you do about this, you know, horrendous gang violence, however you might feel about the children on the border? It's been well documented. that there's tremendous gang violence against very young children in Central America, the kidnapping of girls in Nigeria. How do you dial that back?
These are really big problems, Robin, you know, and there aren't any quick fix solutions. What we need to do in the short term is show humanitarian compassion, and in the medium to long term, we need to really address the infrastructural decay that has led to this, the lack of jobs, the lack of opportunity, the proliferation of gangs, the massive consequences of U.S. drug consumption on Central America. So I think those are some of the issues.
But, you know, when you say things, I'm thinking worldwide, you know, solving some of the economic inequity in other countries you've mentioned as well will be better for children in the long run. I mean, it feels as if solving some of these problems that are leading to the violence will ultimately be better for children, but that feels so impossible.
No, of course you're right. Those are enormous problems. I mean, I think in Nigeria, the girls who were kidnapped, you know, that's one aspect of a situation of destitution and of gender-based violence, which has been endemic for a long time and which I think in a way we're complicit in. You know, we have young Nigerian girls who have been trafficked to Europe, and we've done very little about it.
It's so interesting that you say that you drew the line to child trafficking, because that has been a huge problem, and yet it's gotten very little attention. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that allowing something like that to happen sort of erodes this time-honored a sense that children should be off limits. If you start eroding that, you maybe come to where we are.
I think that's right. I think what we need to do in each situation is think about the structural causes and at the same time think short term about what can alleviate the suffering of children. But in each situation, there has to be short term, medium term, and long term thinking. And I think we haven't done that much. We really haven't thought of child protection as being a central concern of government. It's not been something where we think structurally about the importance of education, the importance of safety, the importance of skill training and jobs.
That's Jacqueline Baba, professor of human rights at Harvard University. She serves on the board of the World Peace Foundation, and she's been helping us look at what feels like just a very dangerous time for children around the world. Jacqueline, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, let's go back in time now for this edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. And
there goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
And joining us today is DJ Paul Ray, host of the Rhythm and Blues show Twine Time on KUTX in Austin, Texas. He's also a musician and a Texas Music Hall of Famer. Paul, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, and you've been thinking about some older rhythm and blues songs and the covers of those songs. And let's start right now with the song Hound Dog. Now, I'm not talking about the one everybody knows. We'll hear that in a moment. But this is the original, recorded by Willie Mae Big Mama Thornton in 1952.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Now, people may not have heard that one, but they have definitely heard the 1956 cover, which really needs no introduction here.
Well, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Yeah, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Yeah, you ain't have a quarter rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. You ain't nothing but a hound dog crying all the time.
Paul, why did that one blow up and not the first one?
Because it was on television. He was on 1956. He did Milton Berle, and then he sang the song, and then he came back again on the Steve Allen show with a dog in a tuxedo. Suddenly, it was a great big hit.
Well, and what do you like about the first one or the Elvis version? What do you hear differently in the different versions?
Well, it's just different time periods. The cover stuff actually climaxed pretty much in 56 when kids finally figured out when they were buying these R&B records that Pat Boone sounded silly singing Ain't That a Shame, you know, stuff Fats Domino's records. So it's sort of a thing like, I don't know, give me back my records or something. I like both of those versions, but then I like everything Elvis did. and Big Mama Thornton. That's legendary out of Houston.
Well, and here's another one. This is the song Fever. It was first recorded in 1956 by Little Willie John. Here is that version.
You never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
What a great version. And here is Peggy Lee's version from later in 1956, which is much more famous.
Sun lights up the daytime, moon lights up the night. I light up when you call my name. And you know I'm gonna treat you right. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
And by the way, that song has been covered time and time again, but what is it about these two versions that you like?
Well, that's the original version, and then Peggy Lee's record, people jumped on it. She got up to number 12 in the rhythm and blues charts with that, but still Fever by Little Willie John was number one at that time. And that's when the cover stuff started going away. Peggy Lee had to add another verse in the middle of the song to make it a different song. So they wouldn't get sued as much, I guess. I don't know.
Well, let's get to another one. This is the song Blue Velvet. This was originally done by Tony Bennett, but then the Clovers covered it in 1955, and that's the version you wanted us to hear, so let's listen.
She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet was the night, softer than satin was the light from her eyes. She wore blue velvet.
I have to say, I don't think I could have possibly liked something more than Tony Bennett singing it, but that I like more.
Well, that's the Clovers were a huge group in the early 50s because they were the only top 10 only records that they used on the Harlem Hit Parade, and they changed that to rhythm and blues charts. And it was covered later by Bobby Vinton, one of the teen idol guys, you know, the Bobbies and Frankies.
Well, here is the Bobby Vinton version.
She wore blue. In my heart there'll always be precious and warm a memory through the years. And I still can see blue velvet through my tears.
Which one do you like better, the Clovers or the Bobby Vinton version?
Oh, the Clovers, hands down.
well,
my sister Harry was bringing these 78 RPM records at the time that Blue Velvet came out by the Clovers. And before that, I mean, from about 1950, 51 era. And she was bringing these home. So we were listening to that. And by the time I got around to Bobby Vinton in the late 50s, I'm guessing, or early 60s, then, you know, it's sort of like, why bother, Bobby?
Well, we have time for one more. This is The Twist, and it's not The Twist by Chubby Checker. We'll hear that in a moment, but this is by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters.
Come on, baby, let's do The Twist. Come on, baby, let's do The Twist. Take me by my little hand and go.
And here is the Chubby Checker version.
My daddy is sleeping, and mama ain't around. Yeah, daddy's just sleeping.
tear the house down.
I gotta say, they sound almost identical. It sounds like they're both Chubby Checker.
If you really listen close, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, the beat's different and a lot more rhythm and blues. The other one is sort of like teenage dance stuff. And Chubby Checker made a career out of taking other people's stuff, like Don Covey and the Good Timers and just different people. And the most egregious was Hank Ballard and the Midnighters.
How do you think that the original artists feel when they come out with a song and then sometimes 6 months later somebody else comes out with the same song and they're the ones that make all the money on it?
Well, that makes a lot of people mad. Hank Ballard, I talked to him about that, and he said he gets a check in the mail, so he doesn't care who did it.
DJ Paul Ray, host of the Rhythm and Blues show Twine Time on KUTX in Austin, Texas. Paul Ray, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome so much.
Look here, girls. Take this advice and remember always in life. Into each heart, some tears must fall.
This, Robin, is Too Many Fish in the Sea.
I know.
By the Marvelettes. Some people might not. We got all the songs from today's DJ session at hereandnow.org, and you can sign up for our Spotify playlist. Just search for NPR Here and Now on Spotify. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.